file where I will be reading to you from the August 2020 Walter Magazine. We begin with locals. That's not funny. Jack Pittman makes a living as a cartoonist through talent and persistence, by Joel Haas. You've probably seen his work, but it's likely you don't know his name. One of the most successful cartoonists in America and abroad has been working in Raleigh for almost 40 years, but he doesn't have a comic strip or a license to superhero. Instead, Jack Pittman has built his international reputation as an outstanding commercial cartoonist. People of a certain age will remember Draw Me ads on matchbook covers and in the backs of comic books and magazines. The Art Instruction School, a correspondence school, promised a grand prize of a 5-year-long monthly cartoon course with all materials for their annual contest. Pittman won the grand prize. The mail order company never expected he would last the whole course, but they didn't know Jack. Pittman received his art graduation certificate by mail in 1974, the same week he graduated summa cum laude from North Carolina State University with a degree in environmental architecture. 3 months later, Pittman quit his first and only architect job. "The most boring job in the world," he says. He wanted to make his living drawing and selling cartoons. But Pittman encountered a problem. Nobody bought his cartoons. He kept the post office busy for months, sending out cartoons every week on expensive illustrator's cardboard. Just as regularly, the self-addressed envelopes came back rejected. His only freelance jobs were drawing for company flyers and paintings for billboards. Finally, that November, Pittman took his portfolio to the News and Observer. The paper didn't really need anybody to draw full-time, but they did need somebody to airbrush bridal photos and risque movie ads. "I was traumatized," Pittman recalls. "I airbrushed away so many belly buttons that I almost never draw them on my characters." Married by this point, and with a growing family, Pittman settled into a routine. He'd work at the paper, come home to his wife and 3 small children, and draw more cartoons late into the night to mail out. Businesses needing clever advertising cartoons began to buy his work. After 8 years at the News and Observer, Pittman had enough outside business to try freelancing a second time. 12 years later, in 1995, he won his first of 3 Rubin Awards, an annual recognition from the National Cartoonist Society in the advertising division. He won again in 1998 and the third time in 2004 in the magazine illustration division. The ceremonies were a chance to connect with other cartoonists. "I was awestruck after my second Rubin when Peanuts creator Charles Schulz asked me to brunch," says Pittman. Mad Magazine artist Jack Davis presented him with his second Rubin, and Mad cartoonist Sergio Aragonés presented the third. Pittman says the highest compliment he ever got, though, was what Mad editor Nick Meglin told him. "If you'd only been born 10 years earlier, you could have been one of the original Usual Gang of Idiots rather than a later edition." After winning the Rubens, art directors knew Pittman's name and sought him out. "Today," Pittman says, "I've been in the business so long that the old art directors who knew me have retired, and the new ones are rediscovering me. And new projects have opened up, too. A few years ago, he was discovered by owners of an amusement and water parks. Now he has a constant stream of requests to draw comical cartoon maps." One local account Pittman has kept up with is horticulturist Tony Avent of Plant Delights in southern Wake County. The two of them get together to lampoon politics and culture for the front of Avent's plant catalog. Pittman passed on the art talent gene to his children. One is an expert in 3D computer modeling, another does general illustration work, and has an online cartoon strip, Jaywalkin' on the Wild Side, and the third has a master's degree in library science and paints as a hobby. When they were small, I'd draw the cartoon, ink in the black lines, and then photocopy it so they could each color it, says Pittman. Talent, though, he warns, is a wasted gift without discipline. He advises budding cartoonists to practice learning the fundamentals and be persistent and consistent when others around you tell you you're being impractical or unrealistic. When not drawing, Pittman might be found teaching adult Bible study at Forest Hills Baptist Church or playing drums in a local band. Recently, he became a doting grandfather to his daughter's baby son. He and his high school sweetheart, Carol, now live in their hometown of Sanford, though Pittman maintains a part-time studio in Raleigh. By now, nearly all the magazines that rejected his submissions 40 years ago have published Pittman's work. He says the rewards of persistence paid off. And in the gigs department, a life aquatic. Photographer Brad Ipuck finds a new angle on high school swimmers by Finn Cohen. All through high school, Shaw Satterfield rose at 4:40 a.m. for a 90-minute swim practice, then went straight to Green Hope High School in Cary. After classes, it was back into the pool for another 2 to 3 hours before returning home for dinner and then homework. Rise, stroke, read, stroke, repeat. This fall, Satterfield is heading to Ohio State University, where he'll join the school's elite program after winning first place this year in North Carolina's 4A 100-meter freestyle and second in the 50-meter. For his senior pictures, his mother, Beth, made what she felt like was the most appropriate choice. Underwater shots of Shaw in action. It's a huge commitment to be an elite swimmer, says Beth Satterfield, but you don't truly appreciate what an art it is until you see the pictures. The Satterfields turned to Brad Ipuck, a Zebulon-based photographer. Ipuck's been a professional photographer for more than 20 years, but he found his true calling, underwater portraiture, a few years ago when his children joined a summer swim league. I'd take them to practice and just kind of sit there, so I decided to see if I could make it a little more fun for me, he says. He'd already been shooting swim meets from outside the water, but what if he could shoot from under the surface? Getting into the pool offered a new set of challenges and opportunity. It became, how do I get the right light on the water to be able to freeze these motions and those movements and get the swimmers still, so to speak, underwater? Ipuck's images capture the unseen aspects of the sport. From the deck, most of the action in swimming is obscured by splashing and the visual refractions of water. But by shooting from below or to the side of the athletes, Ipuck cuts out the distractions and illuminates the grace and power that goes into the craft. It's not just a stroke. There's a kick and there's breathing, and it's that whole experience, says Lisa Honecker, whose daughter Olivia used Ipuck for her senior pictures last fall at Panther Creek High School in Cary. It's still photography, but there's so much movement in the photograph itself. Ipuck uses a camera with waterproof housings and various lenses, plus studio strobes on the decks outside the pool to light up the water. For a guy who's 6'2", staying underwater long enough to get the shot is a challenge in itself. No scuba gear or weights, he just positions himself holding onto a lane line, then releases enough air to sink to the bottom and get his shots in. It takes under 15 seconds. IPOC generally has to repeat this process multiple times. Beyond capturing different strokes the swimmer is skilled at, say butterfly and backstroke, he'll need to get different angles on each one. Standing on the bottom of a 12-foot pool? That'll get your heart rate up a little bit, IPOC says, laughing. I'm really specific with my swimmers to let me get under, count to three, swim at a moderate pace, and once you get past me, you can stop swimming because you've moved out of my lens. In mid-June, IPOC had his first underwater shoot in about 2 months. The COVID-19 shutdown took a large bite out of his business. It was also his first attempt at recording video of swimmers, which he thinks will be even more popular than the still photography. Even if it isn't, he's already found a niche that keeps him happy and his clients happy. It's so unique and such a different view of the swimmer, he says. I enjoy allowing these kids and their parents to see what they've done for 10 years from a completely different perspective. In culture, we read about resistance and renewal. Plywood murals become symbols for a social movement, by Colony Little. This summer, downtown Raleigh buildings were awash in a sea of color. The artistic expressions were as diverse as the artists who created them. Portraits placed in conversation with text-based works, mingled with punchy graphics and wild-style graffiti. Quiet memorials communed with thought-provoking quotes. A dimensional floral installation contrasted with bold paint strokes and the softer touch of sidewalk chalk. The murals that bloomed throughout the city captured the spirit and energy of a movement. Though the plywood murals became a living art exhibit, their origins were fraught. Through May and June, following the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, North Carolina residents took to the streets in Black Lives Matter marches. The first peaceful protest was eclipsed by a group of vandals that damaged storefronts of businesses surrounding Fayetteville Street, many of which had just reopened after the onset of the coronavirus. The next morning, cleanup efforts brought the community together, patching broken windows with plywood. And in the wake of the destruction, these barricades became blank canvases, platforms for artists to share memorials, manifestos, and calls to action. At the Zen Succulent, artist Caitlin Richelle worked closely with business owner Megan G. Kane to tie together the store's operations with a protest refrain evolved from a poem by Dinos Christianopoulos. Quote, "They tried to bury us. They didn't know we were seeds," end quote. Brilliant cacti pop against a marigold background. But under the ground, the names of unarmed black people killed in recent years are written on just as brilliant seeds, a hopeful gesture of healing, resilience, and renewal. The dichotomy is intentional. I have a lot of rage, and the broken windows reflect more of my current emotions than the paint on the boards, says Richelle. I hope that people see the agony, trauma, and hurt underneath the beauty. Artist Dare Coulter transformed Raleigh Ra's entrance with the reimagined preamble to the Constitution. We the people are in peril. Her text-driven piece incorporates a quote from writer Audre Lorde, messages affirming the business's support of Black Lives, and a protester carrying a sign that asks, "What side of history will you be on?" The words are intentionally provocative. It's not about what's comfortable and what feels good, says Coulter. It's about what needs to be said. An early pair of murals painted by artist Joe Giampino, known as SPCLGST, and Nick Ostatek at City Market, were commissioned by owner-chef Jeff Sizer of Royale. In theirs, bold letters proclaim love and light and Black Lives Matter in oversized letters. The murals force us to reckon with the realities of our present. They encourage us to use our voices and urge us to move forward toward progress, says Sizer. Sizer later worked with the Raleigh Murals Project and VAE Raleigh to raise funds for additional murals through an effort called the Public Art Response. With guidance from an ad hoc advisory committee of arts leaders from Anchor Light Gallery and Studios, St. Augustine's University, the Black on Black Project, and Raleigh Arts Council representatives, the Public Art Response connected artists and building owners to bring 25 more murals to life throughout downtown and Glenwood Avenue, with still more commissioned independently. Jedediah Grant of the Raleigh Murals Project underscores that their initiative was not designed to be a beautification effort, but an opportunity to amplify the voices of Black and persons of color artists and express the community's struggles with systemic racism, equality, and justice. It's not about making the city pretty, says Gant. That's not how you make progress. And that's just what these murals do. They refocus our attention away from the vandalism, reorienting our gaze back to the root causes of protest and unrest. If the public art that comes from this can get people to understand that sometimes the values you held on to were not the right ones, or that the things you know to be true are not the correct things, then it's a good starting point for understanding and listening when people tell you that this is important, says Coulter. As downtown businesses rebuild and recover, the murals aid the healing, and, many hope, will both create more permanent, inclusive forms of artistic expression throughout the city and lead to civic action. Plans are already underway to preserve the murals once businesses are able to fix their storefronts. I am excited for the murals to be exhibited again, says Brandon Cordry, director of VAE Raleigh, to remind us of what I hope will be a moment of revolutionary change, a time when we truly made progress towards racial justice. And next, for the love of the game. The stands may be empty, but the memories endure, by Will Lingo. Years ago, the area around the American Tobacco Company factories and warehouses in downtown Durham was essentially abandoned, home to a car dealership and blocks of empty buildings. Then the Durham Bulls built a ballpark at the corner of Blackwell Street and what is now Jackie Robinson Boulevard. If you build it, they will come, so to speak. The change didn't happen overnight, but it happened. First came a new county jail building, from which inmates enjoyed post-game fireworks. Then an office building sprang up beyond right field. Then the redevelopment of the tobacco warehouses. Slowly, downtown Durham took off. The Durham Bulls Athletic Park, DBAP, serves as the centerpiece. It's flanked by development on all sides and brings thousands of people together around its bright green grass 100 times a year, give or take. Or at least, that's the way it's supposed to be. None of us will forget 2020, but for the Durham Bulls, there will be nothing to remember. Coronavirus stopped all sporting events in their tracks. And while most of the major league sports were able to return for some semblance of a season, minor league baseball had no such luck. The Bulls would have celebrated the 25th anniversary of the DBAP this season. Instead, it feels a lot like it did in the 1990s, deserted, with no reason to hang around in the evening. The Bulls are an icon of the minor leagues, but even more than that, a part of the fabric of living in the Triangle. In 25 seasons at the DBAP, the Bulls have made tons of improvements while keeping touchstones like the snorting bull, hit bull, win stake, looming in left field over the blue monster and its manual scoreboard, though it now sits anachronistically below a gigantic video board. The main concourse brings the familiar smells and sights as people wait in line for hot dogs, beer, and still, inexplicably, Dippin' Dots, ice cream of a future that will never arrive. The bullpens are right next to the stands, down the first and third base lines, and fans test the waters to see how chatty the pitchers are, and maybe score a souvenir baseball. The familiar voices of public address announcer Tony Rigsby and radio voice Patrick Keenis, and the antics of Wooly Bull, including his drive around the warning track in his go-kart, after which it always smells like somebody just mowed the lawn. We absolutely miss all of those things, but the biggest void is sharing the experience itself. No other sport matches the experience of live baseball. No other sport invites sitting back, cracking open peanuts, drinking a beer, and chatting in quite the same way. You can watch baseball and people watch at the same time, and it's almost a given at the DBAP. You know that most people will never remember who won that particular game, nor could they tell you who the Bulls' opponent was. That family with young kids definitely won't be there when the game ends. They played the cotton candy card in the third inning. There's always the cute old duo that is someone who's keeping score. The college kids and 20-somethings who just enjoy outside drinking. Couples on dates and couples dates. Kids in uniforms. Tourists wearing spanking new Bulls caps. Work gatherings with the young go-getters trying to impress somebody. Spouses looking bored, and veterans enjoying the free food. Of all the things we've learned to live without this year, human contact has been the hardest to replace, and that's particularly true of a night at the ballpark, with a few thousand of your closest friends, sharing an experience and then leaving restored, win or lose. Instead of the sounds of the ballpark organ drifting onto nearby streets, this summer it has been the sound of silence. The field hasn't seen a pitch or a hit, and ballpark lights have remained extinguished. But we wait for the time when the light will shine again, and we'll be ready to fill those stands. And finally, from our end note section, Right on Cue by Will Lingo. Wilbur's Barbecue has fires burning in its brick pits again. In June, more than a year after its doors closed, this icon of North Carolina barbecue smoked a pig to welcome friends and family to the new Wilbur's, the same as it ever was. Back in 1962, Wilbur Shirley and a partner, Carl Lyerly, bought Hill's Barbecue on NC 70 in Goldsboro from Fred Hill and changed the name to Highway 70 Barbecue. Within a few years, Lyerly, a sand and gravel man by trade, asked Shirley to buy him out. The name changed again to Wilbur's Barbecue. Then little else changed for another 50 years. Wilbur's is still in the original brick building, with dining spaces added over the years, and pigs are still cooked low and slow in the original pit houses out back. Whole hogs, oak coals, day after day, night after night. Anybody can take a cooker and light a burner, says Shirley, but when somebody cooks on wood, that's what makes the difference. You can taste it in the quality of the product. I grew up thinking that was the only way to cook a pig, to tell you the truth. When the business filed for bankruptcy in 2019, it looked like Wilbur's would follow the path of Allen & Son in Chapel Hill or Bill's Barbecue in Wilson, longtime barbecue destinations that recently closed their doors. Instead, investors came through. Local businessman Willis Underwood pulled together a group of folks to buy Wilbur out, then set about the work of getting Wilbur's back on its feet. "We want generations to continue coming to Wilbur's," says Underwood. With their investment, workers have spent the last few months cleaning, replacing the floors, rebuilding the bathrooms and kitchen, and putting a new roof on the pit house. The new owners fixed what needed fixing while keeping the fundamentals the same. Today, customers who walk in will find the original knotty pine paneling on the walls and ceiling, and familiar, but all new, red checkered tablecloths. They'll know the barbecue is cooked the same way it has been for decades, but will also see what Underwood calls a more pit-centric menu, with more smoked meats and classic sides like coleslaw and Brunswick stew. Shirley, who celebrated his 90th birthday in June, has retired, but many of the same Wilbur's employees are in their old familiar places. "We just didn't want to see the history disappear," says Underwood, a lifelong Goldsboro resident, Wilbur's customer, and barbecue aficionado. "A piece of Goldsboro would be missing if it was gone. We wanted to keep the old, but bring it up to date, and keep serving the best barbecue around." We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.